second case today is appeal number 08-13-16, Staub versus Proctor Hospital. Hear first from Mr. Davis.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Roy Davis. I represent the appellant defendant in this case, along with Mr. Richard A. Russo, and that is Proctor Hospital. This is a case wherein the plaintiff, Vincent E. Staub, claims that Proctor Hospital discharged him on account of his service in the military. Proctor asked the court to reverse a jury award in his favor, and in doing so, it requests the court to revisit one more time that device known as the cat's paw. It is undisputed on the record in this case that the person who made the decision to discharge Mr. Staub was Proctor's Vice President of Human Resources, Linda K. Buck. It is also undisputed that there is no evidence whatsoever that Ms. Buck harbored animus toward Mr. Staub because of his military service. And had the trial court limited the jury's consideration to Buck's motivation for discharging Mr. Staub, the jury could not, consistent with the law, have returned a verdict in his favor and against Proctor Hospital. But the trial court did not confine the case to the motivation of the decision maker. Instead, it allowed volumes of evidence concerning alleged anti-military bias of one Janice Mullally, who was a co-worker of Mr. Staub. Proctor filed three motions.
Wasn't Karinchik? I might not be pronouncing that name right, but Karinchik, the immediate supervisor, wasn't he also at least allegedly upset with the military commitments that Staub had?
Allegedly so, but Karinchik was not the decision maker.
Well, I guess that's one of the issues in this case. Was Buck acting all by herself, or was someone with this animus whispering in her ear to make the decisions that were ultimately made here?
That's certainly one of the issues. I will tell you the only evidence on the record is testimony that was adduced by the plaintiff during his case in chief, wherein he called Staub, or where he called Karinchik as an adverse witness, and he called Buck as an adverse witness and said, "Who made the decision?" Buck testified, "I made the decision." Karinchik testified, "Buck made the decision." Counsel then went on to ask, was Karinchik a reluctant concurrence in that decision? And the answer to that was yes. He was a reluctant concurrence in the decision. It is clear he did not make the decision. Was he in the room? I cannot deny that he was in the room, but he had no input into the actual decision. And in addition, if we look at the record, we find out that Ms. Buck relied on much more than what she heard from Mr. Karinchik and the very limited amount she heard from Ms. Mullally, if anything, in arriving at that decision. This was a situation where she literally had information from sources, and I believe there's something like eight sources that I count in the record for the purposes of making her decision.
In her write-up of this decision, she really only mentions the write-up that Mullally had done back in January.
Right. She mentions that you've been warned before to stay in your department, don't go out of your department, and therefore you're going to be discharged. There's no doubt that she does that.
She doesn't say anything else about what Day complained about or what these three others purportedly complained about. Nothing in that write-up about any of those other things.
Right, but I don't think that's unusual that you would write the employee's job history in a discharge notice. They tend to be rather short and sweet. In fact, she knew since 2001, when she was hired there, that Mr. Staub was a problem. They couldn't get nurses to work in the department there. They had people quit, claim that Staub treated them like gum on the bottom of their shoe. They had nurse recruiters dates. You can't get RNs to work there because his reputation precedes them. They knew he had a flirtatious attitude with the students working in diagnostic tech. I mean, she knew all of these things. She had also heard Angie Day's comments regarding Mr. Staub during the meeting with Mr. McGowan. All of those were factors that were in her mind, even though she did not write down all of those things in the discharge decision.
So let me get back to this whole, the cat's paw
right.
theory and how best to present a case like that to a jury. As I understand your brief, and you tell me if I'm misunderstanding this, you're proposing that there'd be some sort of, before the jury gets involved in this, some sort of determinations made by the judge on maybe whether, in this case, whether Linda Buck was the sole decision maker, whether she conducted an independent investigation before the jury heard all this other information, which I think you argue tainted the jury because it heard about the statements that they didn't like, or this woman, Janice, whatever her name is, didn't like the fact that this guy was gone a lot and seemed to be getting preferential treatment because he was on military leave now and then. So how would you present a case like this to a jury?
Well, let me back up and state that my understanding of the cat's paw, as this court has described it, is that evidence of animus of non-decision makers is not to be presented to the jury unless you can demonstrate that that decision maker was under the singular influence of somebody who did have animus.
All right. But jumping
off point.
Okay. Is it your position that that is a determination that should be made by the judge in the absence of the jury, and only if you make some sort of a showing that this cat's paw theory has legs? Probably a bad analogy, but that only
pretty good.
Only then would the jury get all this stuff dumped on them and have to
sort it out. Yes, Your Honor, and typically it's done with motions in limine or motion for summary judgment. I have another case in this court right now where the judge has said you're not going to present this evidence in front of the jury if you want to claim that these non-decision makers had some input. We're going to have a hearing where you demonstrate that first before it goes to the jury. So I think there are a number of ways of doing it. I think the problem in this case was that despite having the precedent from the cat's paw cases saying you don't parade this in front of a jury unless there's singular influence, the judge, in essence, punted the question to the jury and said, I'm going to let you hear all this prejudicial evidence, and then I'm going to let you decide whether or not you should have heard it.
Well, that's actually that. The invitation to do that was in that Brewer decision, wasn't it?
I don't think it was in the Brewer decision, and if it was, certainly Schreiner and the others sort of clear that up. I mean, I read Brewer as saying juries do not hear this evidence unless you can establish singular influence.
What's the danger in a jury hearing the evidence?
That they can't sort it out?
Well, if we look at we get a lot of drug conspiracy trials up here on appeal, and in those kind of cases, it always there's a ton of evidence that comes in that may is subject to being tied up later, co-conspirator statements and all that. We expect juries to follow instructions on how evidence can be used. Why in a civil case like this isn't that just as good of a rule?
Well, I think if we're going to do that, Judge, we could have a pattern jury instruction that says relevant evidence is evidence which tends to prove or disprove a fact and issue. We're going to let you hear all the evidence, and if you find it relevant, you can consider it, and if you find it irrelevant, you shouldn't listen to it.
This is a very hard thing for a jury to do.
I agree.
I mean, the jury instruction in this case, I think, is awful.
I do, too.
I want to hear what everybody has to say about that, but I don't know how anybody could understand what that is.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that you could frame a jury instruction that adequately explains the cat's paw to six laymen. I don't think that that is entirely possible.
That's the problem. You don't have to explain the cat's paw. They don't even know what the cat's paw is.
But that's what the court attempted to do.
I think that if the jury had been asked in this case, simply a factual determination, did Linda Buck make her own decision to, after a reasonable investigation, to discharge Mr. Straub? Answer yes or no. Rather than this convoluted instruction about the cat's paw.
Your Honor, we objected to that instruction to the point that Judge Gorman told me, you've been heard. I don't want to hear any more about this. You're done. And I know when to shut up.
You had said something about his misgivings at that point, that maybe this really shouldn't have, all this stuff about Mullally and everybody else going in, waving their arms around about her and what she said about him and his service. Is that where that obviously must have taken hold of the whole trial?
It was shortly before the trial, Your Honor. How that came up was, initially, this case was pending before Judge McDade. We'd filed motions in limine. Judge McDade denied those motions in limine, said, no, we're going to allow this evidence in. Then Judge Gorman took the case for purposes of trial. I renewed the motions in limine. He wrote a decision saying, no, we're going to allow this evidence in. Then he said, at the instructions conference, wait. He says, you know, what we should do is we should have the jury make this decision, and I'm going to craft this instruction that explains the cat's paw theory to the jury, and I'm going to let the jury make the decision. That's how that came about.
You mean that at that point there may have been an instruction, as Judge Evans says, yes or no, or something that, forget about all this testimony, your only decision is whether Buck made the decision?
No.
What was the concern then at that point?
Up to that point in time, Judge, I was told that this evidence regarding Mullally is coming in. I've heard your objections to it, Mr. Davis. We're allowing it. And then the court said, well, you know, maybe.
Wait a minute. At the beginning of the trial, he said that then, no. And then, you said at the instruction point?
At the instructions, he had tendered prior to the trial starting court's instruction 6.
Okay.
Which, if you think 6A is a bad instruction, 6 was a terrible instruction. Then, at the jury instruction conference, he tendered 6A, which is the one that you have before you, and which was the one that went to the jury.
You're into your rebuttal also.
I'll reserve some time, Judge. Thank you very much.
And now we'll hear from Ms. Galassi. Galassi?
Galassi.
Galassi.
May it please the court and counsel, I represent Vincent Staub. I'd like to pick up on one point.
Could you keep your voice up, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'd like to pick up on one point that Mr. Davis made, and that was that Judge Gorman, when he reconsidered the motion in limine's, that he said all of the Mullally evidence was going to come in. I disagree with that. His ruling, and I can't recite it to you chapter and verse, was that I am not going to make a decision now as to whether or not that evidence is relevant, but I will allow you to renew an objection at trial if you believe that evidence has come in and is not relevant. Thus, the defendant clearly had the opportunity at trial, if they felt any of the animus evidence was irrelevant because we hadn't shown singular influence, and they never raised an objection at trial regarding any of the animus evidence. We think that the trial court got it right in affirming the jury's verdict, and that we produced sufficient evidence to prove the military obligations were a motivating factor in the discharge.
And you agree that Buck had no animus towards Mr. Staub, don't you?
I have no evidence in the record to say that she had any animus. My point is that the evidence in the record points to the fact that Buck solely relied upon, I'll call it the tainted animus evidence, and that the jury rightfully disbelieved her when she said at trial, oh, I considered all of these other things. And let me go to that point. She created two documents at the time of termination. She wrote a detailed reason for termination, and in that she stated that Staub had received a warning in January and he had ignored it to date. Then
that was the corrective action?
That was the termination notice given to him when he was fired.
Well, no, I'm talking about the warning. What was the warning?
The warning was what we contended was the false Mullally write-up saying that Staub didn't have any patience and had, in essence, ignored an obligation to go help coworkers. Mullally authored that warning in January, a couple weeks after Staub got his second notice that he might be activated. And he was written up by Mullally claiming that he was in the angio department, that he had no patience, and he didn't go help the across the hall, when in fact we proved there was a patient in the department. There was no policy that he had to physically walk over there, that if they were busy they would get a call, and that he had not been previously, there were no previous warnings that he had been ignoring his duties, and that, as Mullally wrote in January, he had never been formally warned in December.
Well, now they're focusing on Mullally's animus and saying that she said something else. She didn't report, you know, he's absent too much because of the guard, and that's not fair. Instead, she's pointing out other things that, taken out of that context, wrong, that's bad, whatever he didn't do or something. And that goes on to Buck. Now, is Buck supposed to go back and say, well, wait a minute, what the real problem is that she's mad about his being in the guard?
Well, I guess that gets to Brewer. You know, the record, I have nothing to say she was anything but a neutral decision maker, but she said, but for Mullally's write-up, which we say was tainted, some of these things from Day and a false report from Korenchuk, she said, but for those three things, I never would have decided to fire him. Well, we contended and showed, hey, there's a taint to all of these pieces of evidence.
Well, now, wait a minute. False report from Korenchuk. On the April day when he was terminated, she asked Korenchuk, go find him. We're going to talk about this. He goes to find him, can't find him anywhere. He comes back and reports that. Are you saying that's false?
The evidence that we put in was that on the 20th, Staub was working with Sweborg. They did their cases. They got finished. They went to go find Korenchuk to let him know they were going to go to lunch. He wasn't in his office. They both testified they left him a voicemail and went to lunch. Now, Korenchuk's report not only went to the fact, oh, I couldn't find him to bring him up here to fire him, but he reported to Buck that Staub had never reported in as Mullally had directed in January. When at trial, he testified he had. And the evidence from Staub and Sweborg was that he followed that directive. But going back to Buck, the but-for causes we proved were false. Now, at trial, she said, well, I looked at his personnel file. I remembered these complaints from several years ago that were unrelated to this, and I relied on those things. The jury was entitled to disbelieve her, that she considered those pieces of evidence when her own contemporaneous documents make no reference to those considerations. There were other reasons to discount her testimony at trial, and that was namely that she claimed that she had had a grievance meeting, which was flatly contradicted by the plaintiff, and she at trial she could give details of a conversation in 04 when at her deposition that had been months and months prior, she had no recollection of what was said in the meeting. So she was impeached. The jury was entitled to disregard that trial testimony that she relied upon untainted evidence.
Well, it sounds like that you're kind of saying that, maybe you're not saying this, Korenchuk and Mullally deceived Buck.
That is correct. That is exactly what we are saying.
And so you go back and show that they deceived Buck, and therefore, even though maybe you're saying it differently, but that Buck did not have terminated with something other than animus.
That is correct.
It was based on information from, I don't want to say animated people.
Animus-laden, I think, was the phrase we came up with.
Animus-laden people that, and she, we'll say, to the detriment of your client, relied on that. That's kind of a, that's a lot of tracks on that gap, isn't it?
I understand, but I think the Seventh Circuit, you know, it is the law that an animus-laden or biased employee who influences a decision maker, and that influence is singular. I'm saying this incorrectly. There's singular influence by an animus-laden employee, that unless the neutral decision maker does an independent investigation, that it's only right that that animus is imputed to the employer. Otherwise, every decision you could just sit and transfer up the trail and say, oh, it was the neutral decision maker. It had nothing to do with the biased subordinate or co-employee.
I guess the trouble I'm having is, what else could Buck do but rely on her subordinate staff? And unless she has some knowledge, some reason to know about the anti-military animus, how does she know that her investigation wasn't independent? It wasn't
okay.
Adequate.
Well, first of all, I guess the one string is if she had, in fact, reviewed his personnel file, she would have picked up on Stubbs' grievance that Mullally had been discriminating against him because of the military. Second, if she had talked to Stubb before she took action and said, hey, I've got this write-up, you know, I've heard these complaints, your boss says you're not reporting in, what's the deal? Why shouldn't I fire you? Well, he could have told her, hey, that write-up was totally false.
So there's a confrontational right the employee has.
Well, Brewer says an employee at least gets to give their side of the story. I mean, otherwise, the employer is subject to being imputed with a subordinate's animus. He was entitled to at least give his side of the story, and if she was going to do an independent investigation and remove the taint of that bias, then it isn't even a matter that she would have had to weigh two different employees' stories. She could have walked down to the angiography department, opened the log for this January date when he was disciplined, and confirmed with the department's own records they had a patient in the room, and she would have been able to see that Mullally's write-up was false. All he needed was a chance to tell his side of the story. Now, and after he was fired, he put in a grievance, and as he testified, she never spoke to him about it. In his grievance, he laid it all out. The write-up was false. Mullally, look at all the things she did. She hated the fact that I was in the military. Korenchuk has been dogging me because he thinks I'm going to get called up. He laid out that these employees were biased against him and that he had not engaged in misconduct. She did nothing other than, well, I think I'm going to believe them. In Brewer, the supervisor, when faced with, well, did in fact the employee engage in misconduct, when he's telling me that the supervisor's report is false and she's racist, she went and checked. Just as in Brewer, the supervisor, once being told that a biased employee is making false or misleading charges. She went and checked a parking tag. Here, Stopp turned in a grievance, laid it all out. All she had to do when faced with his claim that these people are biased because of my military and I didn't do anything wrong, she had to walk down to the department and she would have discovered that the write-up was false. She could have talked to Swieborg, who he said could confirm his story that he had reported in. She did nothing. So she solely relied then, once she got the grievance, solely relied upon the tainted evidence given by these biased employees. She never talked to Stopp. She never got his side of the story. She never bothered to do the things that could prove that Mullally's write-up was false. So there were so many means available for her to determine whether or not he had engaged in misconduct without having to go through the, well, who do I believe, him or her. She had other ways to determine that, and she did not.
What's the remedy in this? Is this a reinstatement, back pay, and all that?
No, the record is that Stubb secured a position at the head of a radiology department in Macomb, and so the only remedy here was were his back wages.
Is that a stipulated amount? That was something like $57,000.
That's correct.
Was that agreed that that was the damages that they?
That was the amount, because at some point with his new job he got above where he would have been at Proctor. The other point I want to make about the cat's paw, and that somehow the singular influence element is treated different than other essential elements in different cases. I don't see, that somehow this case or this type of case is so difficult that a jury cannot or should not hear evidence of all of the elements of the case. There's nothing about this case that would say, well, a jury just won't be able to understand the judge's instruction. The instruction said evidence of animus is to be disregarded unless it's shown to have, that employees was shown to have singularly influenced the decision maker. So the jury was told you're not to consider evidence of animus unless the plaintiff proves singular influence. The judge considered at the directed verdict stage or motion that there was sufficient evidence of singular influence, and so he didn't just throw his obligation to the jury. This isn't any different than if you had a horrible car wreck. Is there anything that more prejudicial about animus than injuries that you would make the plaintiff first testify and prove the negligence of the driver before you would allow the plaintiff to talk about her horrible injuries? There's no reason to bifurcate and require some sequential proof of the elements of a case.
Okay.
Thank
Time's
you.
Up.
To follow up on Judge Tinder's question very quickly, what else could Buck have done or what could she do? Exactly what she did do. She made the decision initially to terminate him on April the 19th. She gave herself a day to think about it. That night she went through his personnel file. His personnel file is replete with instances of having been warned to stay in his department, as well as the fact that he was fired previously and reinstated conditionally with a warning, stay in your department. What else could she have...
Are those warnings from Mullally?
Pardon?
Are those warnings from Mullally?
No, Karenchuk. The Stubb came in and was terminated. He had a chance to argue his case at the termination meeting. She heard that argument. He filed a lengthy, five-page, maybe seven-page grievance. She reviewed it. She considered it. She decided, I'm not going along with that. Another point I'd like to bring out is there are two key dates here. April 19th is the day she made the decision to terminate him. April 20th is the day that Karenchuk went looking to find him to bring him down. The decision had been made. Staub testified, oh, yes, I was in the department on April the 20th. It's inconsequential. The decision had already been made. You weren't in the department on April the 19th, and he's never offered any evidence that he was.
Did she have that grievance at that point?
She got the grievance after that. After he'd been fired, she got the grievance where he set forth all of his defenses. She considered that grievance, and she denied it.
Denied the grievance.
Denied the grievance, and he remained discharged. So, you know, did all these other people have singular influence? No. She acted independently in doing this. In conclusion, I'd just like to point out that Proctor is a hospital that is led by military people. It employs military people. It has a policy supporting the military. It's received awards, including those that Mr. Staub caused to be generated for its recognition of the military.
There's, the jury hear all those questions?
The jury heard all this. There is no credible evidence that Proctor or Ms. Buck was motivated to fire Mr. Staub because of his military service. Thank you for hearing our case.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement. Thanks.